Live.
All right, welcome everybody to Schaefer Baseball Report Wednesday edition. The boys are back together. Todd Friedman, Andrew Zeich, and me.
Three Musketeers.
Yeah, that's right.
We've been remote for a little bit.
Yeah. Well,
you've been remote.
I've been remote. I'm on. So we're joking because my buddy Mike Salvino's down. You know, pops down there. We decided that we're on spring break since March, from March till May.
Yeah.
So it's like old man spring break.
Oh, I believe it.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, that's good.
The house is beautiful. The place is good. I tell you, man, it's one of those places that, you know, it's peace of mind for me with like severe ADD.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a mess. I'm total, absolute mess. But that place is just calming. It's amazing. You know, you get up in the morning, the intercoastal and the ocean. You guys have seen it.
There's something about that when you wake up next to water, right? Like you see it. It's calming.
In the morning, the waves crashing.
Oh yeah. So it's been a lot of fun. I've gotten more work done down there. You know, I get up, I do what I have to do in the morning. Then I go right to my desk and there's no distractions.
Sand yoga. He's doing sand yoga.
I don't believe it.
I'm going to soon be. Volleyball. Yeah, how's my tan look? Pretty good.
It does look good.
You should see my flap abdominals. I've been working on those. I got layers going.
Look at you.
But the beauty of it is, you know, being down there in Wilmington, I've seen some great baseball.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and it'd be good to get Chris Burke's take on this when we bring him on. But you know, we always talk about, you know, the delta between high school and college. The delta between high school and Division I, like a high Division I program, like an SEC, ACC, they're not considered Power Fives, but you're talking about a Coastal,
Sun Belt.
Wilmington is just playing phenomenal baseball. They're a really good, scrappy team. I like them. I think everybody down there is doing a good job. I think they were like one or two in the country defensively. Yeah. We'll talk to Chris about the OTZ when we get that on too with Bobby Miranda. But
that's right.
You know, I've seen him in some beat NC State ACC team. They come out and sweep Towson, which you know I love Matt Tyner. You know, he's one of my closest friends. But you know, it's kind of funny. It's almost like going to a PG event,
right?
A perfect game event, and then so in your conference you have dudes. You know, you got the like we do when we go and get bracketed at PG, and then you end up, you know, you got those teams at the bottom of the barrel that they're dangerous enough that maybe one day they can, you know, one game out of three they can put some pressure on you, maybe pull out a W. But overall, you know, they just weren't as talented, and you can see they came in, they were, when they got off the bus, they were undersized to begin with. And there was some skill set guys on there, and there was some decent arms on there, but there was just no real power to the program.
Well, we talk about the high mid-major, you know, Power Five program has those guys on the bench, has those extra pitchers that lower D1 mid-major does not have, right? So the margin for error is so small for a Towson, so especially playing against the Wilmington.
You're right, the depth in pitching. You know, it'll cycle all
the way down. Tremendous.
I'm watching the game differently because of the OTZ thing the past week. That's been interesting.
Yeah.
You know, watching, you know, count the hit by pitches and then pay a little bit more attention to walks. And the slug is pretty impressive too.
It's funny, you know, we take all this data, and it's great that Bobby presented that to us because it is, you know, it correlates. But then you look, you know, you watch a movie like Moneyball, right? And you learn about on-base percentage and things like that. And it's like the whole idea is scoring runs. How do you score runs? Guys on base, you know? I mean, that's and limited.
You're talking about OPS now, right? So everybody's talking about power. Right. Everybody's OPS driven, but you know, it's, you know, I spent time last night with Billy Merrifield, who I played with in AA with the Angels in 1986. And he was a dude at Wake Forest. He was a high draft pick, led the country in home runs, hit 29 home runs his rookie year, not in the big leagues, but in A ball, hit 29 home runs, and they told him it wasn't good enough because you only hit 270. Now he's a god.
I mean, it's,
you know, now it's like, you know, yeah, you hit 29 home runs and you hit 270, you're a superstar. Yep. You're getting big bank.
I mean, batting average has become such a not to me, but to the higher is a meaningless statistic when it should be.
So, yeah, another thing I want to bring up when we get Chris on, too, is, you know, 2 weeks ago, whatever, the double play against the Mets, and I don't remember the name of the guys, but the guy slid straight at the bag, and he slid on his body and went past the bag. He just kind of clipped his – and they want to start a brawl. I'm going back pulling pictures up when I played, man. I'm blowing up catches, getting blown up myself, you know.
Please look at YouTube, Jeff Schaefer in Seattle. That's
that mother's just like, are your only highlights violent?
Are you punching someone?
Yeah. Great brawls and great takeouts. But you know,
it's
interesting because I was a middle infielder, and Chris will tell you the same thing, man. I don't know if he played in that year. I think he did.
He's my age, so he played in the early 2000s.
You know, they were coming after you. It was a pride thing to take a guy out at second base and break up a double play. You knew they were coming for you when you were in the middle infield. And when you took in and out, which I watched these guys take in and out, it's almost like a formality. It's nothing. But every time I took a double play feed around the bag, I jumped, even in the in and outs, you know, because that was, you had to get up all the time. You had to learn to throw the ball, get in the air, get up, because you're going to get hit. And if you're planted, you're going to get hurt. If you're not, you're gonna feel it, but you're not gonna get beat up. So, you know, there's so many parts of the big league game now that it's different. It's difficult to watch, and
it's different. You know, listen, there's some things that these new rules with Rob Manfred have brought on, you know, but there's a lot of things that just, man, the game is great. You know, the game's always been great. You know, but I understand, like, viewership, keeping guys healthy. I mean, the money that's involved with it. You can't have your shortstop who's making $40 million a year get hurt. I get it. You know, I'm with you. I'm with you, Schaefer. That's what they're thinking, you know.
Oh, of course. It's all investment. Listen, if the guys that own the teams don't care about the players anyway. Right. In my opinion, they don't, right? All they care about is appreciation of the franchise, and then they're gonna turn around and sell it for billions of dollars. It's happening through the minor leagues now.
Yeah,
people are gobbling up
minor
league facilities because you know, the appreciation is there. So these groups are, you know, they're forming to make money. So the game, you know, just play the game, do whatever, and hopefully you get to a position. You know, you're in the playoffs, and obviously we got a World Series hero on here today with us, that big home run and
NLDS.
The DS.
Well, we could say World Series. Chris would appreciate it.
Yeah. Why not?
That's right.
We our stories get bigger anyway.
That's right.
I didn't tell you how great I was. I didn't tell you that. Yeah. 5 years as a utility guy. You're not very great. You hide.
That's
what you do. You learn to hide. So when they go picking guys to send down, like, they can't find you. So, okay. Can't find Schaefer. Well, you got to go.
That's right.
You got to go.
That's right.
But you know, last night's game, and obviously I'm a Seahawk fan, you know, I mean, I'm really pulling for these guys, and I'm pulling for every kid on the field. It's fun. But I'm also watching, you know, Dylan is getting his situational playing time and things like that. Also learning how this game is played at a different level, because it's big league. It's big boy baseball at that level, right?
So that's right.
He got thrown out stealing last night, and he had a baby lead because he was afraid of getting picked off. Well, you got put in the game to steal a bag. You got to take some risk.
Aggressive.
And reward,
right? That's right.
And so he's learning a lot. And I'm watching him because I'm down there. I don't go to all the practices, but I'll go to the games, and I'll get to the field early to watch BP. You know, if my son wasn't on the field and playing, I'd go to a field anyway just to watch.
I'm the same way.
That's another thing with the big leagues. We used to take BP and infield, and everybody was in the stands.
Yeah.
Now nobody's there. They let him in it, you know, just enough
time. Or they're at the 10 restaurants that are in the stadium.
Holy cow, man. That Durham place is beautiful, right?
Isn't it?
I mean, I love the back. I like the skyline here in Charlotte.
Yeah.
Really cool with the lights. But that was cool because, you know, all the restaurants
Phenomenal.
Were right there. At the Durham ballpark, the AAA stadiums I played in, they were like rusting and falling down and dusty. I don't even think they watered the infield with a garden hose, you know, clovers everywhere.
That's right.
You know, it was rough stuff. But what a good game. So they had two guys, Tanner Thatch, first baseman for Wilmington, and Nick Kurtz, right?
Yeah.
So two of the best players in the country.
You got to bring Kurtz up with Chris for the draft. I mean,
my opinion, he's a 1-5 guy. I mean,
he might be. Yeah.
He's showing that.
Yeah.
I mean, he's showing the power. He's showing the bat speed. He's showing the pitch recognition. He's soft around the bag. He's really good. So both those guys were, the same. I mean, Thatch is a phenomenal first baseman. It's the first time I really seen Kurtz. I was kind of locking in on him. You know, because Salvino and I got in there early, and we were watching BP and all that other stuff. But he's just smooth. He's just soft. I mean, I look at those two guys and said, okay, they're big league first basemen. They're potential Gold Glove guys.
Sure.
You know, so one's a sophomore. Tana's a sophomore, and
junior.
And Kurtz is a junior.
Yeah.
He's draft eligible.
Oh, yeah.
This year. So. But yeah, a lot to talk about.
Awesome.
I'm excited that we have Chris.
Yeah. No.
Do the intro, man.
Yeah, this is great. You know, typically we're having college coaches on, but, you know, I was talking to Shayla. It's kind of good. We had Bobby on last week. It was great. Brought up, you know, some great, you know, obviously on the ESPN. Bringing up some real cool data with the OTC with us, but
OTZ.
Yeah,
OTZ. You corrected me, I'll correct you, Andrew. You're next.
No, you got it.
Yeah.
When the what's it out? Win the zone. No,
own the zone.
Obviously, I can't even spell. Well, that's a good day. So
too many letters. OTZ. Yeah. Win the no. Yeah.
So, little intro to Chris. I mean, obviously, 2001 SEC Player of the Year at University of Tennessee. In 2001, he was a first round pick of the Astros. I believe it was 10th or 11th overall. And then obviously his big moment in MLB was 2005 walk off NLDS home run to win the series. And then after his career landed at ESPN, he's the head college baseball analyst. He's the one who does all the games in Omaha. And recently, University of Tennessee Hall of Fame inductee. Under further ado, Chris Burke.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Burkey, what's up? Yeah, sorry to make you blush for all those good accolades there, but definitely had to give it. And it's funny, most of our guests who we bring on, we give them a list of things we want to talk about, and Chris's answer was whatever you guys want.
I love it.
So, you know, Chris is a good talker. He's a great storyteller, so I'm really excited about today. Excellent. So, Chris, kind of, you know, we bring our, you know, first question we tend to ask is kind of give a background of you before, you know, you became Chris Burke. Grew up in Louisville, went to St. Xavier High School, very, very high level high school program with a lot of history. Why Tennessee? Being a Kentucky guy, thought that maybe there'd be some other options, but why the Vols?
The simple answer is it was the best program closest to home. It came down really between Tennessee and Notre Dame, and I think Notre Dame thought I was going to go there. And one of the reasons they thought I was going to go there is my brother's best friend was their best player at the time. He hosted me on my visit. What they didn't know was I knew how cold it was there in the spring. Paul Maneri was the coach, and obviously being at ESPN now for so long, I covered Paul for whatever, 6-7 years when he was still the coach at LSU. And he always used to give me a hard time because I said no to him. And I said, well, Paul, I didn't really say no to you. I said no to the South Bend weather. You know, if you'd have been at LSU, I'd have probably said yes. So anyway, Tennessee was, I'd say more to the point, I think Tennessee, and I don't think I realized it, you know, we all know there's a lot of things you don't realize when you're 18 years old, but it was the perfect style of play for me. Perfect head coach for me. I tell people all the time, Rod Delmonico and Larry Simcox aren't perfect people, but they were the perfect coaches for me. They complemented each other very well. And most of all, they let me run. They just go do your thing. And then even to the point where, you know, Coach Delmonico, I tell this story a lot when I talk to coaches. My first 2 years, I got a ton of hits, stole a ton of bases, had a lot of success. And when I was leaving after my sophomore year to go play for Team USA, Coach Delmonico pulled me in the office and he told me I just set the school record for doubles and hits. And I'd hit over 400 and I'd stole whatever, almost 60 bases. And you'd think most coaches would have been like, hey man, just keep doing what you're doing. And he called me in, he said, hey man, there's more power in your swing if you would just get loaded up better. You know, you get to your front side too soon. You don't really separate at the top. I've been talking with Jim LaFever about your swing, and you hit all these doubles. And we had a, you know, everybody thinks about Tennessee's park now. They think about it being small. It used to be one of the biggest parks in the league, but they've moved the stands out. And so home field closer to the plate. So there used to be a ton of doubles and triples in that park. But Coach D challenged me to learn how to get more out of my load. And I took him up on it and ended up hitting 20 home runs my junior year. And so I hit 4 my sophomore year and I hit 20 my junior year, all because Coach Delmonico wasn't afraid to coach me. And my other numbers went up too. It wasn't like I hit more home runs and struck out more and hit for a lower average. All my other numbers went up too. So, I like to tell that story, number one, to praise Coach Delmonico, but number two, to give an example of, to coaches, like, don't be afraid to coach your best players. You know, that's, I think, right. Sometimes, Shape, you know this, in minor league baseball, it used to be really bad. Like if you were a high pick, nobody would say anything to you because nobody wanted to get fired. Like, don't mess with the first rounder, you know, as opposed to like, well, wait a second, I'm struggling. Like somebody help me. I need somebody coach me. So I'm very grateful for my time at Tennessee because I learned a ton. I was allowed to play a style of play that was very conducive to my skill set, but I was also developed and challenged to become a better player. And so, you know, grateful for that. And then, you know, I was raised by a coach. My mom was my biggest cheerleader. My dad was my best coach. And that helped me navigate the way through pro ball, which is all about making adjustments and dealing with failure and learning how to play hurt and all those kinds of things, you know.
Two things in that conversation. One, I wasn't a first round pick, and they talked to me all the time, and it was basically, Shafe, go get that bag of balls and bring it over here. So everybody else. That was one. But number two is, you know, everybody's talking about launch angle and all these different things, and I'm sure you're on social media like we all are, and you know, the battle between Fry and the Hitman and all this other stuff and launch angle. But you know, your power came from learning how to load and separate. It wasn't so much, you know. So the plane of your swing, did it change much? Your plane, because that's a big part of blast.
Yeah,
blast.
That's right.
You know, that created, you know, were you still trying to hit line drives that created more backspin because you had separation and load? Or was there some type of, did you take a different angle on your swing? I like it. Look at the face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He loves this stuff. He loves it.
Getting ready.
You're speaking my language. What I would say as far as the conversation that you're talking about, I take issue with the term launch angle because launch angle is simply a measurement of how the ball leaves the bat. There's always been launch angle. We didn't call it launch angle, but Shafe, you never took a round of BP where you weren't concerned with the way the ball was leaving your bat. If it was a hit and run round, you were concerned with getting the ball on the ground to the backside. If it was a drive the ball in the middle of the field round, you were concerned with hitting line drives in the middle of the field. If you're having fun in the last round, maybe on a day when the wind was blowing out, you were trying to launch a ball in the left field seats. Like, no, I don't know a good hitter that ever made a swing where they weren't concerned with the trajectory the ball left their bat at. I don't know one. Now, we might disagree on the trajectory we're trying to achieve. We certainly might disagree on the feels associated with how to achieve those trajectories, but gauging the trajectory and, if we're being honest, the speed, like everybody is all – to me, there's never been a great hitter that wasn't trying to hit the ball hard and on a line. I don't know one, okay? Now, my line drive might be a little different than Carlos Lee's line drive or Lance Berkman's line drive or Adrian Gonzalez's line drive, like – or Jeff Bagwell's line drive, like I had less room for error with the ball at a higher launch. Now we just called those fly balls, but you know, like there's always been launch angle. We just didn't have a number associated with it. Along those lines, no good hitting coach has ever yelled at a kid for hitting a line drive over an infielder's head. Shafe, anybody ever get mad at you for that? Coach ever tell you, Shafe?
They were surprised
I did that. What's that?
They were surprised I did that, but yeah, nobody yelled at me.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe you needed to do it more, but that was the goal, right? That was the goal. So, like, what we know now is that 15 degrees is a line drive over the infielder's head, okay? We also know that that is the highest batting average on balls put in play. So, you know, I like to tell high school coaches or college coaches, if you were ever telling kids not to hit line drives over the infielder's head, don't do that and tell them to do that. And if you're currently telling them to do something different, you might want to think about the ball flight that plays the best for all hitters. Now, depending on your horsepower, which blast helps us determine, your launch, your ability to hit the ball higher and get away with it, becomes relative to the athlete you're dealing with. Back to your specific question, and the league is very much similar to this now, as much as Coach Delmonico loved to run the bases, he also knew that three-run homers were very helpful. So we would always spend the last two rounds of batting practice trying to hit home runs. Now, some people, that gets them in their feels, and they don't like the way that sounds. But what I would tell you is when a coach is telling you, hit the ball over the fence and you can't, you start to make adjustments as a hitter. Okay, why is the ball not going over the fence? Am I not strong enough? Am I not spinning it well enough? Am I hooking it foul? Am I cutting it towards center field? Like, and then you start to make adjustments with your swing playing. Again, not based on technology, but it's all about getting into the result of the ball as it's leaving your bat. So what I would tell you, Shape, is as I got, you know, my third year in college, really got in the weight room, started to separate better, started to see the ball go out of the park more. It wasn't so much that I was trying to swing more up. It was really, I was just trying to catch the ball more out in front. So if you'd asked me what was my goal first and second year in college, I was always trying to hit a line drive over the pitcher's head, you know, all BP every game with the rare exception of a team at bat. I was trying to line drive over the pitcher's head. My junior year, I was trying to hit a ball off the left center field wall. So I was tweaking my contact point and my desired result. And I had the confidence that I could make that swing play in the game without pulling off the ball and making bad swing decisions. So it all just kind of came together.
You know, you tell, I mean, I tell my hitters, think of external cues, just like you said, you know, trying to hit it off the pitcher's head, trying to hit it off the left field wall, like giving a player an external cue is a massive value for them because then they don't have to think of everything else. The swing is about feel, right? And again, we talk about blast, we talk about swing plane percentage, how long your barrel's on the swing plane and creating momentum. That's what you were doing, you know, your junior year with the separation. Pre-pitch movements is going to help you create that momentum, you know, and torque that's coming towards the ball, right? And that's the whole idea.
And learning how to get into your big muscle groups, right? Learning how to use your speed and strength and athleticism. You know, Shape, I think you would agree that there was a period of time where people were characterized very much by size and strength on if you were allowed to be a home run hitter or not. Whereas now we have tools like blast that tell us our bat speed and our rotational acceleration. And that might come in a Travis Bazana, JJ Weatherholt body, which is 5'10", 185 pounds. Or it might come in a Jack Caglione body, which is 6'5", 230 pounds, or a Nick Kurtz body, which is 6'5", 230 pounds. But just because you're 5'10", 180 pounds, if you're producing world-class bat speed, and your bat's on plane with the ball, why would I tell you to hit the ball on the ground and run? Why would I, you know, why would I do that?
Seaver King's a good example of that at Wake Forest, watching him last night. And I'm sure Chris is familiar with Seaver King. He's a phenomenal athlete.
Yeah.
Phenomenal athlete. And he's not the biggest in stature, but he hit balls hard in BP.
Hard.
Somebody else. Really hard.
Yeah.
So that was impressive. So, you know, the thing. So you're talking about getting into the big muscles, right, that generate that type of power. There's kind of it's not as easy as you say, because you have to do it somewhat relaxed and then figure out how to explode the big muscles, where these guys, we get bigger and stronger, we get all tight and whatever, and they get in a cage and they grip and they hold and they're tight and everything. So the big muscles aren't even firing the right way. They're actually slowing down and dragging. So there's, you know, again, it goes back to you feel, right? So now we're in a teaching society as far as baseball goes. Everybody's going to go get a lesson. Nobody's just going to go throw up rocks and hit rocks, right? Like we used to do, like anything. If I had a stick and I saw something on the ground, I'm gonna pick it up and try to hit it. I didn't think about it. I have to get my hands here, do this, right? It was all feel. So I was able to do that as a smaller player in the game. But now everybody's so headstrong on, and I get it. Bigger, stronger, faster athletes, great. I love it, right? But how do you take that bigger, stronger, faster athlete and create that relax, that mental feel, that smoothness to it? Because smoother is quicker, right? Looser is quicker. And you see a lot of these guys that you know, they look great in BP, but they're not catching up in the in the game to what we're seeing, plus velos.
But we also have metrics now that can help us take the anecdotal evidence out of it. You know, when we were hitting, some coach said, oh, yeah, that was it. Like, okay, he liked it. But does the numbers tell that story, right? Okay, coach, you said that was faster. Blast motion tells me it was the exact same. Now, feel and real and all those different things in between, the reality is you now have the opportunity. This is why guys are, you know, there's a lot of reasons, but this is why guys are throwing harder than they've ever thrown. and they're being able to manipulate breaking ball. Now they're not necessarily getting more outs, but there's right. now more data that helps them attach movements and sequence of movements to results that actually can be measured, as opposed to most of our era was, we used to joke, we had a hitting coach. If you went back to the cage with him, you were going to come out with his stance, period. Like, he was a great hitter, and it worked for him. And we always used to laugh, like, oh, you've been in a cage with, I won't say his name. Yep, yeah, okay. How'd you know? Well, I could tell. And that's fine. That's fine. It's some of those things transferred up from player to player. But for the most part, I think we're never going to take the art out of hitting. But the science of swinging, I hate to say this because some people are just not going to agree with me. The science of swinging really isn't up for debate. Like, it really isn't. The body moves the way the body's supposed to move. The bat moves the way the bat's supposed to move. Now, whether that's what you felt or not, I'm totally open to that conversation. But Alex Rodriguez can say he was swinging straight down at the ball. Like, we have the tape. He wasn't.
Yeah. Right. Right.
He's the one that hit 750 home runs, so or whatever he hit. I'm not telling him to not feel what he felt, but that's not what he did. It isn't.
Right.
So a young player, if he gets in the hands of a coach that tells him that's actually what's supposed to happen and that's actually what a young player does, that player's not going to like his results. That's not going to go right. well. You know?
Right. So you see yeah. more stock, like you're talking about. You see more stock stances in the game now,
right?
Than you used to see guys that could create, open, come in. I mean, there were guys hit wide open, dove in, relax, whatever gets you to that point, that position to hit. And to Chris's point, I had this conversation with Jack McDowell about throwing, and Jack had a great rookie year, struggled his second year, and they sent him down to AAA. And they changed his mechanics on it. And he had a funky way of landed on the side of his foot, and his arm was in a different position. But they tried to change something. So he went back and he threw the ball, long toss, before long toss was really popular. The doc said, throw the ball as far as you can throw the ball. And your body's going to tell you how you have to do that, right? It doesn't always have to be mechanically. So, to your point also, Chris, all these guys are figuring out through these metrics and all these sciences, like, okay, I'm going to get max out of everything I throw. I'm going to get this velo. But it's not turning into strikes, right? So the guy I was with yesterday is Billy Merrifield. That's Whit Merrifield's dad. And Billy and I were teammates. And, we were just talking about, strength and everything. And we used to laugh because Billy's line drives would carry to an outfielder and be an out. I said, I wasn't strong enough. Perfect. Right. I hit them where they couldn't, just enough to get over the shortstop's head or whatever. But our BP was to the point – hit the ball on the ground. So I knew what I needed to do, so I wouldn't take a home run round,
Right.
I had to put the ball on the ground. I had to make sure I was executing my bunts and BP and do all those other things. The guys that had the power, their BP, their misses were pop flies to the warning track. So, but nobody was saying, you had your timing, and that's a big piece I'd love to hear from you, Chris, because timing, I see more guys struggle with timing, not just, okay, you're going to load, but are they loading at the right time?
Right.
Are they coming forward? What's your take on teaching timing? Because that is a field.
You said a lot there. What I would say to Blackjack in today's world, there might be still some organizations that are not super into, the numbers and the ability to track the way the body moves. But really, in today's world, if a pitching coach takes a talented youngster and tells them you've got to change, I would say almost always it'll be, and this is the reason why. Like, here's your KVS data. Here's your Rapsodo data. Here's, your fastball. It's 96, but there's no ride. There's no carry. There's no – like, we got – you see what I'm saying? Whereas back in the day, you get the wrong pitching coach who just – I remember a buddy of mine got drafted. He was a four-seam curveball guy. In today's world, they'd have loved him. Like, four-seam curveball guys don't work anymore. You got to throw sinker slider. Why? I don't know. You just have to. You see what I'm saying? In today's world, you'd like to think we have enough things to measure people by that if a coach is going to ask you to change, he's going to give you a very specific reason backed up by significant data that's going to tell you why. From the timing standpoint, I think that goes into it doesn't matter how scientific we make this game. Some people can and some people can't. I mean, it's just all there is to it. Like some people can get up their barrel to a fastball and some people can't. Now, if you've got a drastic hole in your path and I can get you on blast motion and show you how sloppy your barrel is to the zone, I might help you get closer to being on time. But like it's pretty wild. I mean, as a guy who has four kids and watching them come up the ladder, some kids can get their barrel to ball, some kids can't. And that's not to say we can't coach people. We absolutely can coach people. But when it comes to, you know, I was telling somebody the other day, Shafe, I think hopefully you can tell I'm very much a go-between old school and new school, because I think they all have their place. At a certain level, I never thought about swinging faster. Never. Like if a guy was throwing hard, if we're facing Valverde or Farnsworth or Wagner, and I know the ball is going to be thrown 100, 102 miles an hour, I'm not swinging harder. I'm going to try to swing sooner. I'm going to try to swing shorter. I'm going to shorten the bat. You know what I mean? Like, and I think some of that people get real easy, and some people like, that's a hard thing to grasp. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't think you match bat speed to velocity, right?
No,
so it's timing. So for me, I would go get it. I actually went and got a heavier bat. If somebody threw harder, I went and got a heavier bat and just try to get myself started early and just get it out there and let his velocity.
Shorten your movements. Yeah, shorten your movements, shorten the bat, shorten your stride, whatever you got to do. Yeah, and some of that's just, some of that's feel, some of that's innate. Athleticism that's really hard to measure, and it's even hard to train, because you know everybody's doing the high velocity machines now, but like it's not an arm, you know.
Well, it's like, you know, I mean, like you just said, Shafe, about being tense and being like, you know, I like to say be quick, not so strong, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about, Chris, you mentioned rotational acceleration, and there's a lot of different ways to interpret that metric, but I like, you know, obviously, I like it because it creates, it tells you how well you create separation, you know, hip and shoulder. But also, guys who have high rotational accelerations don't have to be so strong and tense, because Corey their Seager. Lower half,
Corey Seager,
right? Pete Alonso, yep. Mookie Betts. I mean, those guys don't have superhuman, but they move their bodies in the right way to make themselves loose and quick, which is exactly what these pro guys look at when they talk about rotational acceleration. Yeah.
I think Mookie Betts is probably one of the great examples of the modern day game, because, you know, at 5'9", 175 pounds, I think 50 years ago, he would have still been probably an MLB all-star, but I think his the way his baseball card reads would probably look very different.
I mean, it's impressive. Just if you and there was a great video actually I saw on Twitter with Anthony Volpe of like literally his hips were completely engaged around and his front shoulder didn't move. Mm. And like he barreled up this ball and hit it, you know, 110 miles an hour. Exactly. And that's what I try to tell young hitters. Yeah. I mean, the hardest thing to teach a young hitter, when I say young hitter, I mean anything, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, is how to move their bodies the right way. They think they have to be stronger, so they pull the bat into the zone instead of letting their body and their lower body do the work. And that's, I mean, the best hitters in baseball do that.
The best hitters in baseball are on go mode, right? So you're starting your swing on every pitch unless it's an automatic take.
Yep.
And then you stop. Where a lot of times you'll see guys now that, you know, especially we were talking about the Delta, and you might have heard that the difference between high school and a high level Division I program right now is, you know, these guys are trying to speed everything up with it instead of kind of slowing down their head and slowing down the game. And I guess, Chris, for you, I mean, you were, you know, exceptional high school player, exceptional college. The game was probably slower in your head than it was the most. But it took a while for me, not defensively, but offensively, to figure out how to slow the game down in my head, but not in my body.
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes with experience. I think also there's a, you know, the part that is really tough with hitting is your eyesight.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the secret nobody likes to talk about is like the average major league vision is like 20/13.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a, I don't know how much LASIK makes up for that. I don't know, you know, the percentage of players that are playing with contacts, but the vast majority of major league hitters have way above normal eyesight, and the decisions you have to make and the time you have to make them and the ability to read ball speeds and pick up the seams of the baseball, you know, the difference between some and others is huge. I remember a guy in Double A asking me, when do you see a slider? And I was like, well, you know, it depends on who it is and all those kinds of things. But I was like, you know, for me, I'm hoping to see the angle of the guy's wrist before he releases it. And once he releases it, I'm hoping to see the trajectory of the ball change. If the trajectory of the ball doesn't change, then I'm hopefully going to see the dot on the ball, and then I'm going to make my swing decision. I was like, when do you see it? And he was like, right when he gets the home plate, maybe, you know. We had the biggest laugh about it because this dude could swing and miss with the best of them, you know. And I looked at him, I was like, man, that makes a lot of sense. Like, and so I just think, you know, this dude never made it because he just couldn't identify pitches. He just couldn't. Now, when he ran into the ball, it was light tower power. Couldn't read and identify pitches.
Well, consistent contact, right? And 6-4-3 charts, Chris, you know it well, right? I mean, bat the ball skills is number one. I mean, that's the thing I look at. If you're on playing a consistent, you know, part of your swing, your bat the ball skills is going to go up. You're going to be in the game a lot longer. That's just a fact, for sure.
Well, I think one of the great draft questions will be this year where Blake Burke goes, because if you look at Blake Burke last year, I think he hit under 200 in SEC play, and his swing decisions, if I could show you his swing decisions last year and then show you the hitter that is batting second for Tennessee today, they look like two completely different human beings. And you, if you want to feel good about a player's ability to develop and learn and grow in the craft and the art of hitting, watch Blake Burke, because he is leading the SEC in batting in SEC games. He's got a 27-game hitting streak, which is the longest in the country right now. And he hit more backside foul balls and two-strike counts this weekend than he probably had his whole previous two seasons at Tennessee. And when you ask him about it, he goes, man, it's just – he really kind of related it to – or what he said, I related it to golf, which is he's learned how to play different shots in his back. He used to have a driver. That was it. He had a driver. Now he's got a knockdown 7-iron. He's got a sand wedge. And if you watch him, he can back off a club and play it low into the wind. Like last week, the wind's blowing straight across the field. He lets a ball get in on his knuckles and just slices it out to left. I mean, it was like – He has made more improvements from this year to last than any player I've ever witnessed. And for a kid that can literally hit the ball as far as anybody in the sport, it'll really make you feel good about how kids can improve. Like, they're not finished products. They're allowed to get better. And Shafe, you know, the old adages of letting the ball travel, using the backside of the field, are what has changed this guy's whole career, His whole career.
Well, that's always been a two-strike approach. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's something that's kind of almost, it's, I won't say it's obsolete, but, you know, you don't see very many adjustments with two strikes. And that was always my, you know, approach. When you say I hit more ball, you know, I'm fighting just to put it in play.
Right.
I mean, my approach for two strikes was never like, okay, I got to get a hit out of this. My approach was either get a walk or put it in play. And if a hit comes out of it, that's great. So that's, you know, that's.
You know, I do think difficult. There are more kids with a two-strike approach now than people give them credit for. I do. I think it's easy to watch the strikeout totals and think that, especially in college, like these coaches don't care. Like these coaches are not worried about your baseball card. That you better have a two-strike approach with these coaches, or you're not. They're too deep of rosters. Like, now you get in the big leagues. Do some of the power hitters, you know, do they? Back off with two strikes? Maybe not. But I'm telling you, the college kids, like every great college program that I cover, they spend an immense amount of time on two-strike approach and physical adjustments and mental adjustments. Now, whether the kid's executing or not is a different story. But to be fair, the stuff that is being thrown out at them in college baseball is is pretty loud relative to, you know, past history. I think they're trying. Just some of these kids are still learning themselves. And, you know, you go face Chase Burns with two strikes. You don't want to get to two strikes with Chase Burns. Like, please, no. Let me hit the first thing over the white part of the plate. I'm out of there. Please.
So, Chris, obviously, you know, lead ESPN college baseball analyst. We definitely want to ask you about this year. We're halfway through, aren't we? Almost halfway through the season. Who do you like right now? I mean, when we talk about Omaha and we talk about, you know, obviously the SEC, ACC, Big 12 programs, but who's kind of like a hidden team that no one talks about that you think
Seahawks,
has a chance?
Man, the Seahawks.
Let the man talk.
A hidden team. Man, I'm so, you know, like, it's interesting because DBU's lost their last two series. Yeah. And they've become a pretty big name brand. So that's, you know, it's probably not fair to call them a hidden team. And of course, Campbell, I feel like Campbell's operating at a pretty high level too. So it's hard to call them a hidden team. You know, I think it's hard. Like last year we had Oral Roberts was the darling of Omaha. And I think with the transfer portal, I just think it's going to be really hard for the mid majors to break into Omaha on a consistent basis because the funnel has gotten so narrow at the top of the Power Five game because they can pick everybody's dudes off now. So, you know, I will say, I think one of the best stories in college baseball is Florida State. I mean, they were dead last in the ACC last year. And Link Jarrett in year two, you know, has them, they're going to be a top five national seed, and, you know, they're right there with Clemson to win the ACC. Pretty impressive stuff in year two. And yes, they've gotten some dudes in the portal, but a lot of it is just the development of players on their own roster. You know, James Tibbs is going to be a first rounder, and Arnold's leading the country in ERA, and, you know, Ferrer and Cam Smith, like they got a bunch of dudes that have been there. Right. And they're just playing at a very high level. And it's a complete team. You look at their team batting, you look at the ERA, you look at the, power numbers, like they're going to be there in the long haul. So I do think that's a great story. But man, it feels very ACC, SEC heavy. I hate to say it, but even the Big 12, like, I don't even know how to make sense of the Big 12. Like, what am I looking at? You know, Oklahoma's like 11-4 in the Big 12 and they got swept by Lamar at home just like three weeks ago. What do I do with that? I don't even know. So it's, you know, Wake Forest, Clemson, Florida State, A&M, Arkansas, Tennessee, you know, those six teams are going to be tough to run through.
Kentucky right now is probably playing as good as anybody in the country.
Yeah,
right?
Thank you for calling me on that. They are, and we're about to really find out with Kentucky. Like, it's, here's the thing about Kentucky. First of all, I can't give Nick Mangione enough credit. What he's done at Kentucky the last 2 years is off the charts. And 14-1 is 14-1. I think why it's hard, why I don't think of them top of mind, is they don't have a first rounder. And it's like, usually when you think of these great college teams, there's these headline players that you just can't wait to watch. And with Kentucky, it's like, what I love to watch about Kentucky is the way they run the bases and their middle infield defense. Like, Grant Smith and Amelia Petre are like the best two middle infielders in the country. And that's not usually what sells. You know, what we want to hear about is an ace and the guy that's, you know, hitting the ball out of sight. And Kentucky doesn't really feature that, but they are just as much of a complete team as anybody in the country. And they're playing Tennessee this weekend. So we're really going to learn a lot about how they stack up against another one of the big boys.
That's great. And you're calling that game, Chris, or that series?
No, I'm going to be in Nashville for Vanderbilt in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then so we talked about the teams, and I agree. And Chafe and I talk about this all the time with college baseball. I mean, with NIL especially. I mean, it's really hard when you're stacking the deck with some of these larger, you know, larger programs. Yeah. And you know, I look at Coastal, right? And I know Chafe, you know, mentioned UNC Wilmington. I look at Coastal as a team that, I mean, they have the parts, they have, you know, the pedigree that I could see them getting to Omaha again. But you're right. I mean, they don't have that NIL coffer that a you know, an Arkansas has or a LSU. And so
yeah,
it's a real challenge for sure.
Well, and I think if we look at the major league game, like the Dodgers haven't won it in the last couple of years. The Braves got knocked out last year. The Yankees haven't won it since 2009. So just because you're spending the most money doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win at all. That being said, I think the thing where I really empathize with the players, you know, not to get too into the weeds, but like, let's say you're UNCW's best player. You're probably on a 55% scholarship.
Right.
Okay. So you're paying $25,000 a year to go to school. Well, if you find out that Wake Forest wants to give you 75% scholarship and they're going to give you 30 grand in NIL. So now you're not only are you not paying a dime to go to Wake Forest, but you're putting some money in your back pocket and you got a chance to go to Omaha. Like I'm all, you know, that's a hard place to put kids. And, you know, in the high level sports, or excuse me, not the high level sports, the full scholarship sports, football and basketball, like all those dudes are on full rides. You know, the difference between 500K and 600K, whatever you, if you want to poke at that, go ahead. But like, in college baseball, when you talk about the fact that kids' parents are still paying significant amount of money for them to go to college, if they got a chance to change the math of that, it's hard for me to fault the kids, you know. And you know the coaches are going to take them because they're all fighting for their jobs. So
it's part of the landscape.
Yeah,
I mean, I hate to say it, but it's, you know, it is a tool in the game now for a kid to make a move. You know, it's free agency every year.
And honestly, you know, we talk about this all the time. You can't blame the kid. You can't blame a kid if he's at, I don't want to name his school. He's at a mid-major U over here and he's paying, like Chris said, he's paying 15, 20 grand. And then LSU says, well, hey, buddy, you were a first team all conference, third team all American. Come play here. We'll give you 100 grand.
And you got a chance.
Right. I mean, yeah. And you're going to get drafted probably higher, yeah. You know. So.
You're on TV every weekend. I mean, how do you pass it? I think about the problem is, you know, Shape's generation and the guys that even came before him, they sacrificed so much so that guys like me and the guys that are playing now could make the money they make and have some of the freedoms they have. But you still have to play 3 full years in the big leagues before you can make real money. And then you got to play 6 before you can be a free agent, right? Now you're a free agent after 1 year. Like at some level, we do have to have some sort of there's going to have to be some rules put in place around what the player owes the school. We all like that the players are making money. But there's got to be something that binds the two together, you know, not to hijack this conversation into NIL. But I know for me, you guys brought up the home run I hit in the postseason. Like that turned out to be a little bit of a turning point in my career. Like I had this big moment for an organization and they wanted to keep me until Biggio got his 3,000 hits and went off to the sunset. The best thing for me at the time would have been to go play for somebody every day. That would have been what was best for me. And if coming off that World Series deal, I could have been the postseason deal, I could have been a free agent. Heck yeah, I would have taken it. Yeah, I love the Astros. That was fun, guys. But like, am I going to start? No, you're still not going to start. Okay, well, thank you. Here, you know, and so, you know, at some level there's, you know, the players are only doing what they're being allowed to do. And as long as the rules are the way they are, they're going to keep taking advantage of it. And I don't blame them.
I think we'd be remiss if I'm glad you brought that up. If we didn't talk about that, you know, I know we got a few minutes left. Walk us through that game. And that was an 18 inning game, correct? 18, 19 inning game, like the longest 18, playoff game 18. In the major league.
Yeah.
Just walk us through that. That whole scenario, getting up to that point where you hit it, like, you know, had the flow of the game, crazy, like where you were, like.
Crazy story. So we're up 2-1 on the Braves, best of 5. It's Hudson versus Brandon Backey. Game 5, if we have to play it, is going to be Pettit versus Smoltz. And Pettit is sick as a dog. They sent him home. He had 103-degree temperature. So he wasn't even in the dugout. So – it had a very must-win feel. Like, if we lose, we're getting right on the plane, flying to Atlanta, facing John Smoltz the very next day. So they get up 6-1 on us. Adam LaRoche hits a grand slam in like the third inning. That game had everything. Adam LaRoche hits a grand slam in like the third inning. We're down 6-1. It stays 6-1 until the eighth. Berkman hits an opposite field grand slam off Kyle Farnsworth, their closer, to make it 6-5 in the eighth. Going to the ninth, Farnsworth gets the first two guys out, and I always feel guilty about getting so much praise for that game because truly, Berkman hits a grand slam in the bottom of the eighth, and then with two outs and nobody on, Brad Ausmus, who had three home runs that year, hits a home run over the 404 sign to left center field off of Kyle Farnsworth to tie the game up. Two outs and nobody on. I mean, I don't know what the new school percentages were at that point, but they weren't good, you know?
Not very good.
So Lance said, if people ever question the modern day miracles, just go back to that moment. It was hilarious when he said that in front of Ausmus. It was hilarious. So that ties the game up. Okay, that ties the game up. So next thing you know, we go into this battle of the bullpens, and actually in the 10th inning, Berkman hits a two-out double. And probably, you know, Phil Gardner was a classic old school manager, pure gut. Like, you talk about a guy that would not want to hear the analytics department. Like, this dude was all gut. So with two outs and a runner on second base, he pinch runs me for our best player. Okay. Takes our best player out of the game and pinch hits Bagwell. Cause we had been in all these double switch kind of things. Pinch hits Bagwell. Because the double switch had put a pitcher behind Berkman. So he pinch hits Bagwell. And Bagwell flies. So he fires two bullets on one play. Bagwell flies out. And now Bagwell's out. Berkman's out. And we got the pitcher hitting in the four hole. So we go, you know, it turns into just a battle of bullpens. They're throwing up zeros. We're throwing up zeros. And Roger Clemens, who I went back in the – I always went back to the cages about fifth or sixth inning, get loose, take some swings, get ready to pinch hit or double switch or however I was going to be used. Roger Clemens was in full lather throwing batting practice to his senior in high school son. Full lather. Like, Rocket didn't throw, like, short arm BP. He's throwing gas to his kid. This is like the sixth inning. Well, come the 16th inning, he tells Phil, like, hey, man, I've been up and moving. Like, I feel pretty good. Phil's like, all right, well, put your spikes on. Like, we're probably going to need you, you know? So I remember I'm playing left field, and like the 17th inning, there's like a big roar in the bullpen. And Rocket, I look out there, and he's the only person out there. We'd used everybody else. Roger Clemens, who had never made a relief appearance in his 23-year career, is sitting lone ranger in the bullpen. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty surreal. And the story goes that our bullpen catcher asked him if he needed to get loose. He said, I already am. And so sure enough, I come up. Roger gets put in the game in the 16th. So I guess that was the 15th. He must have gone out there. He gets put in the game. He throws up a zero in the 16th, a zero in the 17th, a zero in the 18th. There's one out. He's up to bat. I'm on deck. He is such a superhero that the whole place is on their feet for his at-bat. The whole place is on their feet for his at-bat. He's never hit a home run, never came close to hitting a home run. I promise you, even I was like, this dude might hit a home run. Like he's just a superhero, okay? So Joey Devine's in the game, and Joey Devine's like over here, 94-96 with like a frisbee slider. Miserable at bat for a right-handed hitter. Like, no fun at all. So Rocket strikes out in like four pitches. And I kid you not, people have asked me like, what's it like hitting under that kind of pressure and the pressure? And I'm like, pressure? The whole place like went to go get a beer after Rocket struck out. Nobody was paying attention to my at bat. It's like, everybody was like, oh, here comes Burke. Like, this game's going to 19 innings, you know? So the place, you could feel the air come out of the place. So it was the craziest thing you've ever felt. So I go up to bat, and I'm serious. I don't like shape. Were you a right-hand hitter? Like, you know what I'm saying. Like, this is no fun over here, right? So I'm like, Chipper Jones has been playing third base for 6 hours. I'm like, I'm going to drop down a bunt, steal second base. Maybe somebody can score me with a single. So I go to, if you watch the bat, I go to bunt. And I used to like to bunt sliders. So I thought, you know, this guy, first pitch, he probably don't want me to ambush him. I bet you he throws me a first pitch slider. I'm going to bunt this slider, get a good run and start out of the box, steal second base. We'll win the game. Well, he throws this slider like to the backstop, like. So I'm like, okay, he's probably not going to throw another slider. It's a 1-0 count. I got nothing to lose. You know, the ball's running in towards me. I'm going to try to ambush one here. Well, he almost hits me with the 1-0 pitch. So now my eyes are really on the inside part of the plate. It's 2-0 count. And just what we talked about earlier, I'm like, I'm going to get the head out of here and try to launch one. And sure enough, he throws me a sinker. If you go back, it's like really inside. And I, you know, I look back and I think, man, I did a nice job of staying inside that ball. But I, it was one of those at bats where I was thinking about hitting a home run. I got a pitch to hit a home run on, and I hit it square. And it was really just more of a line drive right into the Crawford boxes. And we win the game. Simple as that. Crazy story, though, the whole circumstances around it.
That's awesome.
It's got to be one of those things, too. When you tell it, it just gets better and better every time you tell it.
You're just as excited every time. I'm going to tell that story.
I mean, I'm sitting here listening. Yeah. I'm just, like, moving forward. Yeah. And, you know, that's just
– Well, there's so much more of the story than me hitting a 2-0 heater out. You know, people ask
No, the story was phenomenal. It was perfect. Yeah, Clemens thrown to his kid in the bullpen.
Oh, gosh.
He's going to hit a home run. That's even better.
That's amazing.
That's awesome. So, hey, Chris, so before we go, I do want to give Bobby Miranda some love here with the OTZ. Have you looked at that? The on the zone stuff that he's
he and I are going to set up a call. He shot me some of the screenshots of it, and I need to dig into the weeds of it to really get a grasp for all that it entails. But yeah, I'm familiar with it on a very surfacey level.
Yeah, it's just pretty interesting. It is. He brought it up when we were on the show, and then I'm down at the staying down at the beach in Wilmington to be around the team and watch my son play. And but I had time, and I started to look at it more and more. And it's almost too simple to believe, because right. it's four categories: it's hits, walks, hit by pitch, slugging. And how do you control that and whatever? But it spits out a ranking, and it's almost hits, the first thing that went.
Walks, it's identical.
Hit by pitch and slugging. Okay.
And that's into some kind of blender, and it comes spits something out, and it's showing why Kentucky's number one, and it goes down. Listen, it's pretty accurate. It's very accurate, and it's a simple thing, but it's a whole different way for me to look at the game now,
right?
Because I am paying more attention to, walks and sluggers, and like I said, Towson came in and they had no power whatsoever, right? So they might have matched you in hits, but it didn't match you in slugging.
Right.
How is that? So hits, hit by pitch, walks, and slugging. Isn't that just OPS?
Yeah.
Well, pretty much.
And then how well you pitch against it.
Yeah, it's how you pitch against
it. So how well you pitch against slug.
You got to own the zone. You got to stay in there. So you don't want to hit. You don't want to hit batters. So it's not an offensive statistics. It's basically.
It's a pitching statistic.
Yeah, it's both. It's both.
Oh, okay.
So how do you defend against that, and how do you create that
right.
as a pitcher?
That's it. Yep.
That's how it goes. So it's really it's been interesting, and the way the rankings have come out through this OTZ is extremely close to what the rankings are on a national level.
Almost identical. It's crazy.
But it takes a little bit more. It's not a one game thing. It's not a three game series. You got to compile. Some data along the way to spit it out, but it is really interesting. And so I was as a guy that goes to the game, and now I'm looking at it a little more in depth than I always have, which we're baseball guys, we see the game a little bit different, and we look at it in a certain way, and it's kind of twisted that up a little bit. So it's been enjoyable.
Awesome.
Worth the conversation with Bobby Moe and just kind of listen to it. Because my first thought was Vegas is going to jump all over this.
Yeah, that's right.
FanDuel and all that. they're going to be all over this thing.
Interesting.
For us setting odds for who's going to be there at the end.
But, cool.
So it's really your OPS. So it's really your OPS and then your OPS against.
Again,
that's pretty much what it is. Exactly.
Like
The teams that have the highest OPS and the lowest OPS against win.
Yeah.
Basically, that's.
Yeah, I Bobby's
I can buy that. I definitely can buy that. Yeah. That makes sense to me. That That makes sense to
Hold
me.
Hold on, can we bring Bobby in right now?
Yeah, he's listening. I'm telling you, he wants to dial in right now.
That was my elevator speech. Get a bunch of people on and hit a bunch of homers, and don't do the other when you're on defense.
That's right. I think that makes sense to me. Awesome. Yeah,
throw strikes, get ground balls, base hits, don't give up bombs, and don't hit anybody.
There you go. You got a shot.
Awesome. I like it.
I'm in. Awesome.
Chris, thanks so much. Really, this was fantastic. Yeah, this was great. You know, all this information is super helpful, very entertaining. So, no, we really appreciate it.
Les, how are you enjoying the analyst side of it?
How do you,
it's a blast. I never am wrong. So it's great. You know, even when I'm wrong, I'm right. And it's so easy to care, right? I get to pitch around people. I get to not bunt. I get to bunt. Yep. I get to sit on pitches. Like, you never – I learned about year three, like, the only way I can be wrong is if I don't actually give my opinion. Like, if my opinion's wrong, it doesn't matter. But all I got to do is just give my opinion. And then it gives us something to talk about. The play-by-play guy will make fun of me because I was wrong. But it's okay. When I'm right, it sounds good. Who cares? But I know I really do enjoy it. I think the most fun part is getting behind the curtain of the best programs and seeing their culture and also seeing how different people do it different ways has been a lot of fun. Watching to see what certain programs value, what certain programs emphasize, how they recruit. And then, of course, the modern day with the portal, I tell you what, those dudes, they got a lot on their plate.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
It's been enjoyable.
Appreciate y'all.
We get to do it again down the road somewhere with us. So
I'd love to.
Thanks, Chris.
You got it.
All right, man. Well,
told you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah,
you guys can close this out.
Adios. Oh, we're good. We'll close it out.
Well, thank you, everybody. Shave Baseball Report.
Strathmore Capital. Thank you very much. Architect Sports, Advocacy Baseball. All Star Game coming up.
And the trio.
Three Musketeers.
I'm gone next week. Peace.
See you guys.